Welcome to Writer House Literary Salon.
June 26th, 2014. From the Stage to the Page. James Magruder, who started his first short story in 2001 after 16 years in show business as a dramaturg, translator, and musical book writer, discusses his new story collection, Let Me See It, and how his career in professional theater has both warped and enhanced his writing. Thanks to our moderator, Gare Galbraith.
Hello. My name's Gare Galbraith. My pleasure to introduce to you Mr. James Magruder here. He has written this wonderful book, Let Me See It. I've read it. I've laughed. I can't believe that I haven't known this gentleman before because it struck a lot of chords with me. It's excellently written, and one of the more notable things about this, it's a series of short stories, mm-hmm. and even covering the same character, some of the chapters are in third person and some are in first person. And that's my first question, is what led to this?
Well, as I think I was saying to Rachel in the car, if you're ever going to link stories, link them ahead of time. Because this is basically all the short stories. I started writing short stories about 10 years ago. And they were basically all me with a different college major. And they were getting published in journals and stuff. And there was a moment where my agent and somebody else said, well, I think these should be linked. And I thought, oh, no. And I thought, I can't do it. First of all, because to link them, I would either have to throw out three and then, or not link them. I didn't believe in my ability to write three completely different stories, say from the perspective of a grandmother or a football player. So it's like I can only write myself with a different college major. But there were two stories in Let Me See It that were very important to me, and they were based on, so I'd say the two things that forced me to link them is it's important that one of the characters gets very hairy. It's like this central thing to one of the stories. And then another story is very important that he had a blue-collar dad. Mm-hmm. So his dad's a butcher. So I thought, oh, my God, I can't make him not hairy, and how can he? And then I just hit upon that brilliant idea of making them first cousins, one who had a white-collar dad and one who had a blue-collar dad. And they almost never see each other, but they do come together a couple of times. And then because I started calling it the cure for cancer story because it had to be the last story where everything culminates and you tie up. And so I just kept raising, it was like I was going to cure cancer. So that was the one that was written new for this book. So that's. So first and third is just like how it took me.
I see.
And one was actually second person, but my editor thought that was,
That would have led one more question from me.
Yeah.
That's it, because he will tell a story from Elliot mm-hmm. in first person, and then the next chapter is about Elliot and not told by another character. And I just found that a very interesting way of telling the story. And I will tell you this, this gentleman, the way he writes is that some of the romance or action, he takes you to the door and you have to imagine the room yourself. And then other times you might as well be under the bed.
Oh, I was wondering where that was leading there.
Well, that came to me when I was being glib. Do you have any rituals when you write? Anything that needs to, like Voltaire said, he had to be naked in a room with coffee or else he couldn't produce.
The truth. I take off my ring. My partner and I, and because I feel like when I'm writing, I have allegiance to nobody but myself. And then really, that's about it. I mean, I wish I had a practice.
Right.
It's best in the morning, because the liminal period, waking up, is when I'll start to make glue with this, by flogging the horses so much, I'm making glue out of what the... And then I get up and, try to avoid Facebook, Gmail, and AOL. And talking Broadway, all that chat.
And do you get a spark of a plot? Or because this gentleman's written, was a playwright beforehand, and I'd like to get into that too. I mean, like, when I was in theater school, one of our professors said, the playwright is only 10% of it. Everything else, you know, from the costumer to the director, and I resisted that at first.
Yeah.
But it's true now, as a novelist or a short storyteller, it's all yours.
Yeah. Well, yes, and I haven't written a play in a while, but I actually did write a play in the last 2 years. I was just at the Kenyon Playwrights Conference with this new play. And I always say it's much harder to write fiction for me, and it kind of goes with what you're saying about the 10%, because if I'm writing a play, I don't have to say, you know, her chestnut curls framed her cheeks, you know, that's the actress. I don't have to do physical description. And you know when you're writing some fiction and it's just unavoidable, you have to say, the door knob, she crossed the room and opened the door. Like, I don't ever want to write that, because you can't boost that up. You can't make that, there can't be a beautiful. And in the theater, that's blocking. The director takes care of that. And then the other thing I don't feel I do well is interior monologue. Interior thoughts. And I was like, I don't have to do that in a play.
Right.
So that's why fiction seems much, much harder. When I first started writing stories, they were all first person. And I think first person is really easy for me, I think, because of my background in the theater. Because those of you who are playwrights know that kind of a play is a competing landscape of first person narrators. So that cliche of, like, they just start talking and you start is kind of true for me. But it is not that way. We're all of a certain age, most of us. Do you remember this Play-Doh thing called a fuzzy pumper? Does anybody? Well,
yeah.
You must be older than that.
Yeah, it must be very. Yeah, you press down really hard. What's like making you press down and sort of the Play-Doh comes out in shapes.
Stars,
right. So that's how I feel like writing a sentence is like a Play-Doh fuzzy pumper. And then the sentence comes out and you put it back in. And then somebody has to answer the door.
And that might take me back to what we were talking about earlier. You know, you had the two voices of your characters in this. Did you have a specific voice as your narrator?
How do you mean?
Well, like, we had Elliot. You know, was your narrator ever part of their lives, or were you looking at it from a distance?
It's not historical third. I can't
okay.
do that yet,
right.
So it's close on the shoulder. And
okay.
again, like, I have some really important friends in Baltimore who, like, in the years when I couldn't get arrested in the first person, in the third person, which is in my acknowledgments, because I don't have an MFA, they would say, Jim, you can't do this, or why are you shifting point of view, or if you do this, or setting up the story.
Right.
We have to really see that he's eavesdropping on, you know, they just went through it the way a workshop would. And so I kind of feel like they're my 12-year MFA in the third person.
Okay.
Yeah.
And who said it? It's a great quote. The God is in the details. Mm. This gentleman, it is amazing, the detail that you bring. You know, and we're roughly the same age, and you ascribe or you refer to certain points that I grew up with, and it's just, and he covers every sense, you know, from sight, smell, and the detail of this. And I wonder if that comes to you right away, or do you have a broad vision and then you narrow it down?
That's a good question. I think, again, because we were talking about plot earlier too, all of these stories have a really strong autobiographical component, but then they veer off. So I don't want you to think like the things that are happening there necessarily happen to me. But I draw from my memories, and if I think hard enough I can remember that room.
Right.
can remember those dishes.
Mm-hmm.
I can remember that store. I can remember my first job, which was the first Tom story. He's working at a make your own sundae parlor. Mm-hmm. Zips, very 70s. And he's making toppings and spreading out jimmies. And I'm cursed. I mean, to have a great memory is both a blessing and a curse.
Right.
But I have really, a really, really strong memory.
And, you know, he mentioned specific television shows and specific that stuff in the background. And I was amazed. I kept underlining so much, I think I ran out of ink. But it is, you read this and you will just go, wow, it takes you back.
Well, you know, that's interesting because I always say, like, oh, I don't have to write. I don't have to write physical detail either of rooms and stuff. So there must be, but I feel I'm okay with that.
Mm-hmm.
But in a play, I don't have to do that either.
No,
the
no.
set designer does it. The props person does it.
For some reason, we get the vibe in the American scenes,
yeah.
or the Parisian scenes,
yeah.
et cetera, that you are capturing not only what it looks like, but the essence.
Yeah.
Very nice. It amazed me because the detail you did so nicely. Who are your influences, please?
Well, Flannery O'Connor, she's the goddess for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
James Purdy. My personal inspiration is Thornton Wilder.
Oh, gosh. Yes.
He's a better playwright than a novelist, and I teach theater at Swarthmore College, and I have no problem saying that Our Town is the greatest American play. It's like Chekhov. It's like the older you get, the earlier you cry. Like this, there was this last revival in New York. I don't know if you saw it, but like Howie Newsom is delivering the milk 5 minutes in, and I'm a basket case. But when we teach it or first encounter it, we're like 15 or 16, and we're the age of the kids. We don't see that life has an anvil hanging over each of our heads. So Wilder's and Wilder was kind of like a dramaturg too, which is another thing I do. But Dawn Powell. Any of you like found Dawn Powell and James? Yeah, I said mentioned James Purdy. I think Forster writes the most. He's better. He writes the most beautiful sentences.
Yes. Any from like our characters start out in teenage years, etc. Any people that grabbed you then?
Oh, well, here's a book that absolutely destroyed me. Here are two things. There's this book by Herman Wouk who wrote Caine Mutiny Court Martial. Over time, he became more and more mass market. But his third book was this, it's called The City Boy, or The Adventures of Herbie Bookbinder. Mm-hmm. And it's basically, he's looking at his childhood in the Bronx. It's like 1923, he's a chubby kid in the sixth grade, in love with a girl with red hair, and he has an athletic cousin.
Yes.
And I found that book in my junior high school, it was either seventh or eighth grade, and it so warped my sense of, I mean, I loved it. And I still go back and read it if I need a lift. But the last, I thought, wow, it all started there. And the other thing was Gene Shepherd. Do any of you remember him?
Yes.
He wrote for Playboy, and then
oh,
they
yes.
collected his essays. The one like Wanda Hickey's Night of Golden Memories.
Right.
And again, it was the same period of like junior, and I was reading Do Black Patent Leather Shoes Really? There was a spate of Catholic spoofy things. So that, I mean, I won't say I didn't have a sense of humor before that, but if you read, I would say go to, Herbie Bookbinder. I mean, that is a great, great book.
Of course, I know.
But nobody knows about it. Most people
well,
know about
do.
It. Yeah.
I know Gene Shepherd from A Christmas Story.
Yeah.
Yes.
I love the story. I don't like that movie the way I'm supposed to.
Because you carry baggage into it.
Right, I carry baggage of like, it's not as good as the story.
They rarely are.
Yeah. They rarely are.
I'd say The Godfather, maybe Jaws.
Yeah. That's a good question.
Or the movies are better than the book, is what
yeah.
my opinion, yeah. Mm-hmm. But no, the books are usually better. What surprised you when you were writing this about either all of a sudden you took a road that you didn't think you would or something didn't work? Or
well, each of the stories, except for the cure for cancer story at the end, is the process of trial and error, and obviously, and it happens again, it happens faster in playwriting. They start talking and they start doing surprising things. Mm-hmm. But with these stories, some of them were like one of my favorites. It's my favorite kind of because it's the only one with a happy ending-ish. It's Elliot Bidler's Vie Boheme, where he's in Paris. And that story was rejected 67 times. By 67 different print journals until New England Review took it. And it took 6 years, and the editor there said, you should have thought of us sooner, but the lesson here is, you finish it, oh, this is marvelous. You feel like, oh, here's another. If you haven't read Confederacy of Dunces, you must. So I feel like Ignatius, oh, this is particularly fine. Agnew wants it, will want it right away. I send it off, and of course, it isn't ready. I want instant gratification. And so that story, I'd say the first 50 times it went out, it just wasn't good enough. And then I had my fictionista friends look at it and say, don't do this, don't do that. So I would recommend you have people you trust read your stuff.
Fictionista.
Okay. And then another surprise I had when it was all over, when I think I was doing the proofing, where it's like, oh my God, you might as well call this book Daddy Issues. Jill McCorkle said, your first book, you got to the mother. And I did that with my first book, Sugarless. And she says, if you can take it, the second book, you slay your father. And so this book is just filled with, and I mean, sometimes I'll look at it and go, God, that is so sad.
Is there any, I mean, like I know Tennessee Williams kept writing Cat on the Hot Tin Roof. Is there anything, if you could grab this thing, and not anything specific, but stuff that you'd like to do over or tinker with or...
That might take a couple of years before I could see it, because again, some of them I lived with for so many years and revised so many hundreds of times that, there's one story in here. It's the only one that wasn't published independently. I've been up to about 63 before the book went into print, and I would just love to really make that story work. Mm-hmm. I mean, it works within the context of the link, but as a standalone, there's something about its tone that's wrong. And then a really close friend of mine read it and said, oh, well, that's that mother. And it was so like, if I had a chance to rewrite this story called Mistress of the Revels, where you could link, because if you read, and I would urge you, should you buy my book, and I hope perhaps you will, you read it sequentially, because it's chronological. But I would try to fix Mistress of the Revels. And now, funny, I think I know how to do it. And it's too late. So, yeah.
And it was interesting what you said earlier about, because Warren Beatty had the quote, he says, just write for five people that you know and trust. Mm-hmm. And let the rest. So you have, are they the same people that you write for and you present it to? Because when I write something, I've learned not to present it to my partner.
Oh.
Because they just gruffs and just, you know, whatever. I don't need names, but are they still the same people?
My fictionista.
The sounding boards, yeah.
Yes, the sounding board is the same. My partner, though, Steve Bolton, and the dedication is to him. It's for Steve Bolton, who heard every word. I read them. When I finished a story, I read it aloud to him.
Yes.
And he'll usually say once, you know, say, oh, it's good. And I'll go like, is it really? And, you know, can you see things? Does it, you know, because sometimes you'll read your own work and go like, this is immaterial. There's nothing here. There's no texture. Even if with all the details, it's like evaporating. And then he'll say one thing that like crystallizes the story.
Oh, wow.
And really kind of helps me understand why I wrote the story. And then, so then I can kind of backtrack and see how to really make that. He just somehow is this he's not a writer. It's some macro vision of the story that was like this, what I tell my students is the secret heart of the story.
Wow.
So.
That's very nice. And in addition to him, I mean, people that you have for decades, years?
In the book, there's four of them, four women in Baltimore.
Right.
Because, again, I haven't been writing. Oh, well, and with plays, you just have to hear them aloud.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And then when you do the first reading.
Yeah, in the first reading,
that's what that sounds like. Yeah,
that's what that sounds like. Or you know when everyone's like bored out of their gourds because they start to shift. Or if there's a program, you hear the rustling. And
I even mean in a first reading.
Yeah.
When you first, is that what you mean? That's, it's no bueno. Light bulb moments. Do you have those where you're in the middle of something and you just can't?
Oh, yeah.
One thing, A doesn't go to Z or to whatever. One, how do you get those and do they sneak up on you?
They can sneak up. I'm afraid of the third quarter of a story. So I'll write the beginning and I won't necessarily know why I'm writing it or where I'm going with it. And then I come up with an incredible ending and I write that. And I skip over the third lap of four because, you know, generally that's where the climax is and all the, you know, and I'm afraid of it. So I backhoe the third lap. And then usually what happens is the third lap leads to a different ending. But I'm so unable to change it. And I think this is why stories would get rejected dozens of times, because the ending didn't match, because I was so in love with my closing moments or sentences that I couldn't. But there is a story in here, the second one, actually Tom's first appearance, where he's making ice cream stuff. I thought I was writing to a certain ending. There are sort of two revelations at the end of that. And one of my teachers says a revelation is not a story. So by itself, a revelation is not a story, and I believe that. So I think the fact that there was a second revelation, that came to me as I was trying to sleep. And I had to stay up all night to finish it. That was like the most inspired moment.
Do you write on paper and pen first, or
no,
keyboard?
Keyboard. Although my first novel, 1,000 years ago, when I thought I was going to die, was longhand.
Yes, sir. I see you keep trying to look at my questions.
No.
That's about it for me. I mean, should we open it up now, Rachel, or...
Do you want to hear a little of it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I will tell you this, too. It's so good, I know I'm going to buy his other one. How's that?
Okay. I could just, you know, actually I was thinking about this on the bus down. Because Greyhound, you know, Baltimore, it's not so easy. But we're in this kind of territory. So I'll read the prologue and maybe a little bit of one story. This is the prologue. It takes place in 2008. Tom Emilio's Aunt Ruth has begun sending him small stuffed animals, the promotional tie-in kind thrown last minute into bags of fast food. This past Christmas, she sent him 3 animals and a knife. It was an 8-inch folding blade that commemorated the Battle of Fredericksburg, with a medallion in relief of Robert E. Lee glued into the butt of the handle. His aunt, Tom knew, had grown up in Fredericksburg in a white clapboard house that had served as a Confederate hospital after the battle. As a child, she was told stories about ghosts and names written in blood in the attic of the old house fronting the Rappahannock River. Aunt Ruth doesn't wrap the stuffed animals. They arrive safe in their plastic pouches, but the Christmas knife came wrapped in an empty box of biscuit mix. The lid was scotched taped shut, and the crinkled piece of block-printed gift paper was clearly a reuse. The knife zipped out of a black leatherette crescent. Dangling from the end of the zipper was a small tag shaped like an animal pelt and stamped with a gold-leafed guarantee of authenticity. General Lee's portrait was painted in gray, pink, and black enamel. Tom doesn't believe in past lives, or rather, he hasn't read up enough on the subject to take anything but a neutral position. But his first cousin, Elliot Bidler, the last time Tom saw him in Paris, had said that he had always supposed, for laughs, that he had to have been one of Belle Watling's girls in Gone with the Wind. Elliot said he had been hot his entire life for white Southern men. Old, young, lumpy, wiry, gay, straight, the Boo Radleys and the Rhett Butlers and every bubba in between. He loved how generations of unmongrelized Scots-Irish blood showed in their bony faces, in their long arms, square fingernails, lank hair, and deep-set eyes. Moreover, they were polite. They knew how to have a good time and let us never forget the molasses drawl and their access to authentic idiom. Elliot confessed that Southern men made him hot because he found something sexy about sleeping with the direct descendants of the doomed boys in gray. Tom is not Southern, and is hardly a Bidler, as far as that goes. In 1954, his mother, Janet Mary Bidler, married Alphonse Emilio, a Korean War vet who became a butcher. The Bidler side turns up in the wedding album, unsmilingly so, but people wore more sober faces for photos then. There was no overt rift. Tom's mother had married down, down and out. The Emilios stayed put on the Kansas side of Kansas City, while Aunt Ruth and Uncle Henry and the 3 cousins seemed to move every other year. Gypsy feet, Tom's father would sigh, transcribing another new return address from his in-laws' Christmas card envelope. He thought cousins should know their cousins. If, in his thank you note, Tom were to ask his Aunt Ruth, whom he's met only a handful of times, why she had sent him a lobster, a bunny, a turtle, and a Robert E. Lee knife for Christmas, he imagines her saying that he ought to take more of an interest in where he came from. He knows her gifts are meant for her son, Elliot, long gone. Tom expects Elliot would have had a field day parsing preconscious motives on his mother's part. A bent for Southern men, Ruth might be warning Tom, could kill him in the end, too. Tom is 48 years old with his own mother to parse. He does not want to make a funny story about how his aunt sent him a knife and 3 stuffed animals for Christmas. Tom doesn't make funny stories. That was Elliot's job. And so that's the prologue. And then we go back to where they're it takes place from 1970 to 1991 or something.
Yes, very funny. I have a follow-up of, what was your relationship like with your cousins?
I have very few of them, and they're all on my mother's side. And there was a magical time when we were all living in New Jersey, like 3 towns apart, and they had a pool and we'd spend. But it wasn't until Facebook that I got really reconnected with that side of my family.
Where in Jersey?
Scotch Plains in Westfield.
Okay.
But if you're asking about detail, it's like that knife. Yeah. I could have located it because that was the knife she sent, my own mother sent me. And I just remembered. I remember the little tag, authentic, you know, if you buy leather goods and it's authentic leather.
And this gentleman, someone crosses a room, the TV's not just on. He tells you exactly what program and what plot points are happening
right
there.
Streets of San Francisco.
Yeah.
So you said that it's so liberating to do theater, to write for the theater, because you don't have to tell
do any
the details,
of
and yet you seem to really love telling those details. Are you happy that the director totally screws up your vision?
Well,
does something different?
Now that's the thing. How many of you write plays? So, you may have discovered already that a really good actor will tell you things about your play that you didn't know. And if they get stuck on something or can't say a line, it's because they're having a problem making the moment work, bridging the motivation. Because, now directors are another kettle of fish, and not good actors, it just sounds like, you know, tapioca pudding, and you just want to, like, scream out the line readings. But you so have to give yourself over to the collaborative process,
right,
and shut your mouth. You do have fine, you know, you are the authority about your play, but you don't know as much as the collective wisdom of the room. So it's that moment to moment. The actors are great. And, you know, a really good director will be able to do that, too. Say, this is missing, or we need this scene here, or, yeah.
I directed one last summer, and the director says, the ending's very down. It's da-da-da. And halfway through it, I looked at my cast and go, we're not doing a down ending here.
Mm.
You know, because we wanted to give some hope.
Right.
And we didn't change the words. It
right
was just in the
uh-huh
added. And this is what they gave me as actor.
Right. And what did the playwright do or say? Did the playwright come see it?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Because it was a great collaboration. We all, yeah. And he didn't say yay nor nay.
I had a production of a play, of a short play in New York, where the ending was ambiguous.
Right.
It was like a mother had blown through town. It's nine. It's so many years ago now. Y2K. So she's moving down to Florida to set up, you know, her battle station because she's Christian. Mm-hmm. She's millennial Christian.
Right.
So she comes, and she's in my first book, like I say, slay the mother, honor the mother, slay the father.
Right.
So she blows through, and she hasn't met the newest boyfriend of her son.
Right.
And so she blows through and completely disrupts mm-hmm by the information she reveals. And at the end, there's this gulf between the two, the partners. Mm-hmm. And that was ambiguous, would mm-hmm they? But when I saw the production, because I was living in Baltimore, I wasn't going up and watching rehearsals. Like they held one, like reached out his hand. It was like, oh, that is like so wrong. I mean, it's wrong for my intentions. Maybe
right
the audience liked it better, but it's like, no, there's a gulf, and I hope you think it's going to be bridged. But I don't want you to. I don't want you, the actor, to tell me that.
Right. I might cover my tail here a little bit. We
yeah
just gave a glimmer of hope at the end.
Right, yeah.
In case any playwrights say,
right, right.
That Garrick Albert isn't touching
right
my
right
star.
Right.
Squirm out of it.
Yes, sir.
Hey, Westfield, I'm Rahway.
Rahway!
Yeah.
Lyndon Rahway. Oh, yeah. Yes, Rahway.
Do you use a Final Draft or a program?
You don't have to use Final Draft for plays yet. I don't. I have my own format, but a lot of playwrights do use Final Draft. But I only learned, I don't own a television, which is kind of my, I guess, response to, like, when people say, you should write for TV, you could write, well, I have to buy one first, and then watch enough of it. But Amy Bloom, the writer, the novelist, she writes a lot of TV, and I met her at McDowell, and she had this show that was coming up in Lifetime, and so she said, well, why don't you write an episode? And I tell you, learning Final Draft was harder than learning the structure of a television show. So I stay away from it.
Excuse my ignorance, what's Final Draft?
It's the screenwriter's program.
Yes, basically.
Oh, I see. Yeah. I see.
For your computer.
Yeah, yeah. And it's actually easy. It helps things, but maybe for my 10th, because I haven't written any screenplays. Don't imagine I ever will. So any Final Draft knowledge I have just went out my ear in 2007.
Mm-hmm. Are you on a Mac or a PC?
A Mac. Okay. A Mac.
Yes, you dropped something a minute ago that I thought was really interesting. It's a keep reading line, but wasn't it? I just wondered. I suspect you do this in your writing too. But what you said was, I almost died, and started writing in longhand.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered if you might want to elaborate.
Well, one of the reasons I sort of became more of a writer is because I found out in 1988 I was HIV positive. And so what I did, I just finished grad school at the Yale School of Drama. And a friend of mine told me about writer's colonies. And in 1988 there was nothing to take. There were no drugs. You had a very finite life, lifespan.
Yes.
So I got into three colonies sequentially and just raced through a novel. It was called Done with the Compass, Done with the Chart, which is from a wonderful Emily Dickinson poem. And its last lines were, I think, I am my mother's son and I am my father's son. Oh, no, I forgot the last line. So funny, the mother, father. So anyway, but then I became one of the first combination therapy miracles, like in 1996. So I was down to like 7 T cells. So I'm where Elliot is at the end of the book. And then, my immune system recovered and I thought, I've got to fulfill my early promise. So I kept downsizing myself at my job, which was at Center Stage in Baltimore, and gave myself permission to be a writer, because I think that's the first hurdle. You have to give yourself permission. And so I was like 38, and so I started writing those short, very queer plays. And then I was in McDowell in a playwriting residency in 2001, and I had a week left, and I thought, instead of going home early, and there was no way I was going to like look into that play again, I was going to wait a while, I thought, well, why not try some prose? You haven't done a short story or anything like that since college. And actually, part of that's in what I just read to you is like my very first, gone over 17,000 times, mind you. But what was more important was that that story suggested three others immediately. And those three are in here. And then what I did was I wrote a story, then I wrote a chapter of my first novel, Sugarless, and I wrote a story, then a chapter. Eventually, Sugarless took over. And then that got published, but I realized, along with the daddy issues, is the last story, splitting them into cousins, is also the split in me, the me that feel I have survivor's guilt during the '80s, when everyone's dying. I was infected, but I was in grad school. I did not act up. I did not assist at 500 funerals. I did not like scream it. I didn't do the normal heart stuff. And I feel guilty about that. And there's a part of me that feels he should have died in Paris in 1991. But there's a part of me that's the survivor. So that's a very long-winded answer to my life was, But I didn't, I didn't know. By 1995 or so, statistically, it looked like I had about 2 years left. So...
And,
yes.
I'm sorry. And this gentleman in one of the last chapters, Elliot, the gentleman who has contracted AIDS, his last cells, his T cells, he's named them.
Oh.
Right. His last 11, he has named his T cells literary and capricious names.
Wink and Blink and a Nod. Kukla, Fran, and Ollie. And then Buster, Trixie, Dixie, Sonny, and Polly.
Anybody know?
Anybody know that one?
Come on, Bill.
Those are the five no-neck monsters in Cat Island. Yes, yes, sir.
You made a couple slight references to your father.
Mm-hmm.
How would you describe your relationship to your father?
Well, my father died when I was 19, out of the blue, in a very sort of stupid way that's all over this book. That's Elliot's side of the story. And I was a sophomore in college. My parents had split, and I didn't see him much. We didn't talk much. He didn't know what to do with clearly this screaming faggot for a son. Except, you know, when I would visit him and my stepmother in New Jersey, he would help me buy tickets to go in to see Broadway shows. So, and I think he would have let me major in anything I wanted, but he died before, and so stupid, or no, so in retrospect, he died the day the hostages were taken in Iran in 1979. And sort of over that weekend, I changed my major from economics to French, never thinking like there was a cause and effect, because my dad was an accountant. So we didn't have enough time to understand one another. And so there was a moment where this book was going to be called Losing Him Twice to Divorce and Death. And actually that sentence turns up.
Wow. Yeah.
And then it was going to be called You've Really Learned How, and which is one of the stories. And then it was going to be called Stiff with History. But my agent thought that was a little too provocative.
More provocative than Let Me See It.
Yeah, well, yeah, I think Stiff with History is... See, the thing is, and you may not want to buy it, it is, I can't not write about sex, but it's not meant to titillate.
No.
It's meant to reveal character and plot elements, and Elliot especially makes a lot of mistakes with older men in his early 20s. So it's kind of like a Hardy Boys mystery series. Why did I sleep with him?
And Tom's more repressed.
Tom is much more repressed and has a more healthy attitude towards the virus. So it's two ways you could go. Because again, if I were 2 years younger, it wouldn't have happened. I would have, like, they would have discovered the virus and I would know to practice safe sex. But I had like 3 years of love.
Yes. Yeah. I was lucky to meet my lover in 1980.
That's great.
Yes,
that's great.
So, I want to hark back to what you just mentioned about your father dying the day the hostages were taken in his book here. It also is such a reminder to the young man about his father, because every day they announced how long the hostages have been taking, and that's how long every day since this young man had lost his father.
Yeah, you turn on the news and be like, day 187,
yes,
the hostage crisis. It's like, okay, that's 187 days since my dad died. So, other questions, anybody? Oh, yes.
You referenced a quote that a revelation is not a story of 100.
Well, we're all on that epiphany model, which is another way of saying revelation. Chekhov gets away with it. But I guess my stories, or stories that tend to be not hopeful, but ambiguous. And I'm thinking of, there was one story I wrote where it's suddenly revealed, and I thought, oh, the story's over. You've got to work with that, so it culminates in an ending that satisfies. I guess it's like one of the truths. Because again, I know MFA. I haven't read any of those books in the back, those craft books. But I did get the inkling that the ending of a short story should be a prepared for surprise. That but then when you think about it or read it again, the author is like laying the bricks for that twist. I don't know what a story is. But I know within the context of like theater, it's much more structured. Novels and again, short stories I think are harder than novels because they can't wander. I dream of writing a sentence one day. It's all another lesson to give, or whatever hurdle, is to believe your own narrative authority. There are certain kinds of sentences I still can't write yet and believe. And like one of those sentences is, several years passed. And I don't believe myself when I say that. Who am I to, you know, an Alice Monroe, like what Alice Monroe can do and William, you know, I just can't do that. And I think it's partly because my background is in the theater, where things are so, plays are usually take place over a short period of time. There isn't like, unless two times are happening simultaneously. So I can't write several years past. I can't write, lit the cigarette. And I think, I don't know where I was going with that, other than plays, because it really is moment to moment. I said good actors will let you know what's missing. With story, or with novels, it could be anything. And I still have to learn with stories, like too many characters. You've got it. It really is tighter than, what do you write? Do you kind of?
I've written social science and now some creative. Creative
Ish. Ish. Yes. Now that's the, I have a really good, you should invite her here. She'd come to the opening of an envelope. Do any of you know Marion Winnick? Any of her work? Like 9 books. She's one of my best friends in Baltimore. And so she teaches creative nonfiction. She has 9 books and they're all like memoirs, and she teaches memoir. And I realized, because people say, well, why didn't you write this as autobiography or memoir? And I realized it's like, no, then I can't make things up.
Wow, yes.
And I want to make things up.
Or embellish.
Yes, or embellish, or like make composite characters. Or, and you know, what's really weird is like with plays, even though a couple of my plays are very autobiographical, I'm like untethered. So for example, I'm trying to write another, I have a third book that I've been working on for 17 years that Northwestern has the writer first refusal, and I hope that sells. But this new one I'm writing, I think I'm trying to write for the marketplace, which means I'm like in the head of a straight woman. She's going to have lots of gay friends, of course, but she's the protagonist. I think, well, I'm writing for the market, but also I should stretch myself. And then I was thinking, I write straight women all the time in plays. But there's something about it being fiction and maybe on a page where I just feel it's easier to feel inauthentic.
Because you're speaking.
Because I have my, yeah.
Exactly.
And in a play, they're talking for you. I'm absent.
Right.
I never thought about that before.
Another thing James does in this book, and I kept finding myself do it, I would get 2 or 3 paragraphs into something, and something would be mentioned, and I would go, well, where's the reference to that? I don't know what this is. But I learned to trust him because it would come in the next paragraph or so. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
You know, never being like...
dense.
No.
Another word for dense.
But what it is, I learned to trust you.
Oh.
You know, it's just like, oh, well, if this is happening, I don't need to, because I can speed read and have ADD and all this.
Right.
But it was very interesting that you didn't spoon feed us,
yeah,
in the first part of a section.
Well, and... could be another reason why I got so many rejections at first. But my first novel, Sugarless, that is so autobiographical. It's basically it's about Jesus, sex, and speech team, or my sophomore year in high school. That is so autobiographical. But I had to make my younger self a C student, an average, ordinary, instead of like the overachieving, like, you know, A student with a tremendous vocabulary. I had to literally pull that back. And so for this one, well, they're both educated.
Yes.
So, yeah, so it's about, oh man. I was just remembering, like, trying to pull back my teenage self into just somebody who's ordinary, and then through the events of the book discovers himself and becomes less ordinary to himself and to others. Anything else? Do you want to know how to write a Broadway musical?
Sure. Don't spill that on us in the last minute.
You should charge for that.
I'm right. Just curious whether you've ever dealt with the same story in both mediums. For instance, written a play and then said,
no, this would work better if I could write it in this fiction, or vice versa?
Well, I have this dream that my very first play, which I wrote in 1985, would make a great novel, because now I know what I'm doing, or I feel I know what I'm doing. This book that's 17 years in the making, I started it, again, I didn't start writing short stories till 2002, but I'd written a novel, started it in, I guess, 1997. And I was just spent the year in Africa, or 10 months before they signed the anti-gay legislation in Uganda, and we had to flee overnight with our overweight cats. But I had to, but I feel like I finally finished that novel, not to my satisfaction, but I also know that, like, I have to get back into that sort of, I would not write it this way now. It would be a completely different book, but I have to honor, or I can't. And I was saying to Rachel that it took 13 years or 12 years to figure out who the narrator was. And the narrator had been on the first page the entire time in a portrait. And I thought, so that's a kind of eureka light bulb.
Yes, yes.
Helped along by albuterol, because I couldn't, I was wheezing. Now I know it's because of the mold at the VCCA in the curtains, which actually makes me feel better. I thought, oh no, I'm going to. But no, I wouldn't. I don't think I would turn a story into a play, because I've worked so hard on it to try to make it. And I usually I never have those, like, oh, this should be, or I write five pages and think, no, this is really a play. I wish I wrote often enough for that to happen, to do like what Tennessee Williams or Fort Wilder did, because basically Williams used his short stories as the fodder for his plays, and he valued his plays more. And I think we do too.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.